Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with A Positive Mind. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays at WBAI 99.5 in New York. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and things to think about. There are, we have many interviews. We interview quite a few book authors, and, you know, they want to sell their book. They bring us the book. We look at them. We look at what they have to say. We like it. The stuff we like, very often we'll have the person come on air to talk to us. When I say us, I mean me, I'm DeMille, and the team of people I have who are researchers here at the DeMille Center who help me, like Rachel Hott, Linda Briarty, but especially Roberta Atti. And I think one of the things we've done over the years is Roberta and I have worked to bring stuff to you, but I think you're missing out on something, because I want to use this time to actually find out who Roberta Atti is. Who is this person who's on the air who talks, who I have such a deep respect for, and why? And I'd like to show you a little of who she is and where she's come from. So, Roberta, welcome to BAI once again.
Hi, Armand. Thank you.
I like this opportunity. I want to start this off with your background, Roberta. You know, I mean, we're going to talk about what you do. We're going to talk about the fact that you're an author of two books of poetry and a book about nutrition. Well, that's what you do. And we talk about that you give people both counseling, psychotherapy, and nutritional counseling. That's your profession. You also do private cooking. You do. You teach people how to cook. You teach people about how to cook healthily. Is that the right word?
Maybe.
In fact, let's start there. Let's start there, and then I'm going to work it backwards. What do you teach in cooking?
The pleasure of working with food, the experiential aspects of creating food that is not only good for the body, but good for the mind, the experience, I mean, the moods, for everything. And often people equate healthy food with boring food, bland, and, you know, almost like a punishment. In order to be healthy, we have to eat a certain way that feels like a punishment. And I am here to say that's absolutely not the case. In fact, the opposite. Once we sacrifice the pleasure of eating, we've sacrificed the most important health-giving aspect of eating.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think that sacrificing...
Because digestion is impaired by a sense of dread and...
Revulsion,
displeasure, or boredom, or anger. I mean, boredom with food, when people say, you know, I'm tired of eating the same thing and I don't know what else to eat... In my opinion, that's a form of anger the person experiences at the lack of excitement and pleasure in the experience of eating. Eating, in my view, see, Armand, I've been all over the world and I've seen how people eat when food is truly perceived as a gift. When people have very little to eat and every meal is a blessing and a gift, and one does not know if and when there's going to be a next meal, then every bite is experienced with a lot of almost ecstasy. That's what I'm talking about.
Give me an example of where that would be.
India.
Tell me about that. You actually remember in India. Give me a scene.
Well, in India, I would share my food with the lepers. And the lepers live in communities that where only lepers can go because they're considered unclean and nobody wants to be around them. So they only hang out with one another. And these are people who are truly abandoned by their society. So I would go and I would buy a box of cookies and or I would go and buy some kind of food and I would go there and share it with them. And then I'm getting a little choked up in remembering. We would all sit around, and these were people with no feet, no hands, no noses, that would crawl on the ground and eat dust and get kicked if they dared to go anywhere where they did not belong. And when they saw me coming with food and You know, I was a healthy 20-year-old. It was like a goddess had appeared, you know, goddess of mercy. Maybe I liked the power it gave me, you know, maybe it was an ego thing, but sitting down on the ground with them and eating this food and sharing it with them made me realize what food is, and I'll never forget. And then the amazing part of it was that whatever they had, they would share with me, even though it meant that maybe, you know, they weren't going to have anything else for the next week, but whatever little they had, they would share it. And there's something about that experience that touched me for a lifetime.
Every morsel is to be appreciated. Every morsel not is to be appreciated, can be appreciated, can be relished. Every bit you eat in some way can have your own kind of gratitude for its existence.
Well, see, we forgot in the land of affluence. We forgot what food is. And I believe that that's why, one of the reasons why it makes us sick when we eat, because we don't understand what we're doing.
What do you mean? What did we forget?
We forget that without it, we would die shortly. So this is a gift of life, and how is it that it comes to us?
Well, it's so abundant. I mean, why wouldn't we? Of course we would forget.
Well, it's abundant for us in a way that's rather artificial, Armand, because the abundance of food that we have comes from exploiting resources that are non-renewable. Therefore, this abundance that we have comes at a price for the rest of the world. I mean, I'm not judging anybody here. I'm not coming from a moral standpoint. I'm just observing. So we're so used to having this abundance that we start to worry about, oh, is it going to make me fat, or is it going to make me ugly, or is it going to make me look old, or is this a craving, or should I really be eating it, and why do I want this instead of that, and why do I really want that food which I know is not good for me? All of this is an intellectual mumbo-jumbo that goes on that diverts us from the experience of eating. If we truly sat down with the food and realized what a mystery it is, how does it come to us that way? How many people are involved in producing it and delivering it? And all of that, we would find out that probably thousands of people are involved in the end for every meal we eat in delivering it to us the way we get it. Even that alone, you know, that awareness alone changes the way the chemistry of digestion happens.
Well, it would make sense to me that what a person would do is if they stop and think while they're eating, or if they stop and think about what they're eating, they're going to slow down their eating and they're going to have better digestion, no matter what they think about. I mean, it doesn't really matter if they think about where it came from or what.
I disagree with you.
That's not going to affect. You think really thinking about where it came from, when we have a pizza to think about, well, where'd the bread come from, where'd the cheese come from, where'd the sauce come from, where the...
I think there's a difference between eating a slice of pizza on the run just because it's there and just because that's what we feel like, and, you know, without any thought of, you know, as to what it is, or maybe a guilty thought, oh, I shouldn't be eating pizza. I should be eating something nutritious. There's a difference between that and eating a slice of pizza with gratitude and mercy. I think it changes the way we digest it, and I think it changes the way our body absorbs the nutrients in it, so that I don't believe it hurts us as much, or maybe it does not hurt us at all if we eat it with awareness. Now, you do know that there's a brain, now we've discovered there's a brain in the gut, in the sense that the same dynamics that we find in the brain that we have inside the skull are at work in the small intestines, the neurotransmitters, the hormones. So when we eat and we put food down the tube, something happens down there even before the food gets down there. Something happens to the chemistry of the body. The body becomes ready to receive this nutrition before it even makes its way down there. And depending on what kind of a state of mind we're in, the body's going to do a good job or not so good a job.
There would be much more we would go into talking about this, you know, but the program is not so much about food as it is about you, Roberta. You know, I could understand your attitude. You believe that the food is something that should be pleasurable, and you believe it's biochemically important for it to be pleasurable, not just psychologically important. You think that they're connected somehow. You somewhere are saying, I think, that the belly likes it better if it's good food. Okay, well, let me just challenge you with one, right? Wheatgrass. Right? My belly never likes wheatgrass. It doesn't like wheatgrass. It just doesn't. And I know wheatgrass is just one of the best foods on the planet.
That's an intellectual decision you've made.
What do you mean it's an intellectual? You don't think it's one of the best foods on the planet?
I think it may be very good for some people sometimes, just like everything else. I don't know that I would say it's one of the best foods of the planet.
Okay, well, many people have said that it is one of the best foods on the planet because, you know, it's like if there had to be a perfect, perfect food, it was probably wheatgrass. You just don't.
Except for the taste, God has a sense of humor then.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the idea. There is some stuff that may not taste all that good, you know.
I think wheatgrass juice is more of a medicine, actually, Armand.
Yeah.
And medicine often tastes bad. And once I met a doctor who said, well, of course it should taste bad. Because then you'll remember not to get sick, so you won't have to take it. Doesn't that make sense?
Well, luckily they have wheatgrass being implanted.
Exactly.
There's other ways of getting it.
Right, that's a better way, if you ask me.
This is not to trash wheatgrass, but we are talking with Roberta Adi, and we're talking about where and how her mind got to be this way and understanding food. I have such a respect for your understanding of food and the nature of the way it works. But more than food, Roberta. I mean, I'm going to go to how did you get to the food part. So how did you become a food specialist? Let's go back in time now.
Well, when after I traveled around the world for 10 years or so.
Between what ages? Was it 20 and 30 or 18?
Yeah, about 18 and 28.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I was sick. And I hadn't been taking care of myself, and I was smoking cigarettes quite a bit. And so one day I discovered that I was sick. And having been raised in the medical world, as you know, Armand, I was surrounded by doctors growing up, and medical literature and drugs and et cetera, I knew that there was no answer in that. For me, somehow.
Okay, so we have to go back just one step then. Your father was a pharmacist.
Right. And he had a lot of friends who were doctors, and so we always had doctors in the house for dinner, for lunch, visiting, and, you know, all his friends in college were doctors, became doctors, went on to get a medical degree. So I was surrounded by them. And
not only that, you were also grew up on drugs, on medication.
My father was very much a believer that, you know, for every symptom there is a drug, because he grew up at a time when fevers would kill people. So when antibiotics were discovered and put on the market, for him that was a miracle. And he believed that drugs were miracles. And so he, you know, whenever I sneezed, there was some kind of drug that I was given. But that was with good intentions. Anyway, so I grew up surrounded by this, and by the time I got sick, I knew enough of that world to know that there was no answer there.
You knew enough about the potential medications that what was used, and how did you learn about what was there? I mean, did you kind of study it with your dad, or?
He would, you know, always talk medical lingo around his friends, and then also with us, me and my sister, because we understood it, since we were around it so much. But also, you know, I found that world fascinating, of course, because he was part of it. So I would read his books, and I would read the inserts of medications. And very early on in life, I became familiar with medical terms and literature and anatomy and physiology and all these things, just from curiosity. But it was deeper than that, Armand. I realized that when I got sick, my body was simply manifesting something I called a soul sickness. So I knew that cutting a piece out of my body or burning a part of it or taking a, yet one more medication wasn't going to help the soul at that point. So I kind of skipped the cutting and the burning and the drugs, and I went straight for the soul. Now, people find different avenues, different pathways to their soul. For me, it was food. I don't know why, but somehow when I asked myself, how do I heal myself, the answer that came up within me was food.
And so in this history, I just want to catch up on that 17 to 28-year-old thing, you know. The 17 to 28 years old, you're traveling in India. And I mean, if I remember right, you were traveling around the world as kind of a jet setter, right? You were, what were you doing? You were modeling, you were...
I was supporting myself through my, I would work in the summer in Italy, every summer when it was warm as a model. And I would make enough money to then leave when the weather started to change around September, October, and come back in March or April. And for the whole fall and winter, I would travel, sometimes to the east, sometimes to South America or the United States.
And included in that was a lot of partying, right? I mean, a lot of experimenting and trying out and doing, you know, drugs.
That was also the time when everyone else was doing
absolutely.
That,
what years was this? The 70s and 80s?
Late 70s and during the 80s.
During the 80s. So it was like everybody was in there and doing everything, and it was kind of fun. And it was fun, and you found, must have found certain amount of peacefulness through the drug world as well, because you were brought up on medications.
I don't know that I ever found peace, Armand. I don't think I was ever very happy doing that. I think I was always in a lot of distress. But, of course, whenever I was in distress, there was something I could do to numb it, medicate it, or get higher, or, you know, move to a different country, go to an island, whatever. So I would run away from it.
And like most of us in the early years, you know, we were brought up on this idea of alter your own mind, and then came the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and it was just, well, of course you're going to take this. Of course you're going to live forever. Of course, you know, nothing's going to damage you. And the truth is, it didn't do all that much damage anyway. You know what I mean?
Well, some people died.
Not as much damage as, remember the scare about marijuana? You take marijuana and it'll fry your brains. The scares was just scares. It did not cause as much damage. LSD, one or two cases we'll find were bad, but it was a Timothy Leary kind of time. But then you said to yourself, you got sick, you know? And what kind of sickness did you get?
I had a precancerous condition.
And there it is. So you're getting some cells, and they're saying to you, oops, watch out. You know, this is you're now in trouble. And you say to yourself, okay, either I'm going to go the route of medicine, which is going to be chemotherapy and whatever else is available.
Slash and burn. It was gonna
slash
be.
And burn.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or?
Or I will listen to this voice inside me that I don't really understand, but seems to be saying something that makes sense. And the voice inside of me was saying, clean up your act, stop the drugs, stop smoking, stop everything that you know is bad for you, and start doing something that's good for you, like eating some real good food. And so I did. And sure enough, this condition cleared without the need of cutting or burning.
Is this in Italy you're doing this, by the way?
No, it was here. In fact, that's the reason why I came here, was to study with Michio Kushi, the macrobiotic teacher up in Boston. Back then, not knowing what I was doing, I just went with the first thing that showed up that seemed like could be helpful. And so it was macrobiotics back then.
And from there, you see eating now sensibly, meaning you're eating, you know, microbiotic or macrobiotic.
I was eating a vegan diet based on brown rice, beans, seaweed, and vegetables. And really, it was quite inadequate nutritionally. But I did it for a few years, and it cleaned up my system. and my condition cleared up.
Now, in knowing you, you don't just do things lightly. You're going to do it and then study it.
Well, yes, that was the first opportunity for me to really study healing with a person who's considered a master. I mean, he has his flaws like everyone else, but he did contribute a great deal of understanding, I think, to this field. So this was an opportunity, and I took full advantage of it. You know, at that point, my looks had suffered because of my partying, and so I couldn't model anymore. So what I did was I would clean houses, and I would clean the Kushi Institute, because I didn't have any money, in exchange for the classes that I was taking. So I was willing to do anything to get the information. And I studied. I did nothing but study. I studied Oriental medicine, Chinese medicine. I studied Shiatsu. I studied facial diagnosis. I studied physiology and anatomy and nutrition and everything I could get my hands on.
You're the most voracious reader I've ever met. I mean, you read everything. You eat it. You digest it. You look at it. You welcome it into your soul. I mean, you love to read, don't you? You love to find out things.
Yes, I really find a lot of peace and a lot of comfort in reading. But I don't read newspapers and magazines, Armand.
You gather information.
Yeah, I gather information as I need. I'm very selective as to what I listen to or what I read, and because I don't want to pollute my mind with things that just wouldn't help me in my quest. I figure I only have a limited amount of time on Earth. And now I don't have time to, read about things that aren't relevant to my quest.
And relevant to your quest is learning about what makes the body healthy.
Yes.
That was the beginning of it, right? And so you started with microbiotics and you started reading about nutrition. Now, but your attitude towards food is that food itself, if it's, do you have a sense that organic food is better than regular food? Do you believe that? Do you believe?
Sure, I believe that what's good for the whole is good for the individual. So if food is produced in a way that hurts the earth, then it hurts the people of the earth because there's no separation between one and the other.
Okay, but what about the food just maybe filled with toxins as a result of spraying it with herbicides?
Right, that's not good.
And that's not good not only for the planet, but it also could kill people. But see, you really believe that organic food is a better choice.
Yes, but not so much because I believe that the individual is that important. I'm sorry, but that's how I see it. I think the whole is much more important. So, you know, I think that taking into account how food is produced is almost more important than taking into account how is it going to affect me personally.
I know you say that, except when I watch you consult with people, you certainly don't look like you're considering the whole. It looks like you're considering the person more than just about anybody I've ever seen.
Well, I'm considering the individual's needs.
Mm-hmm.
But behind that, my most important, my goal is to make a contribution to the whole through the individual. So if I can make a difference for one cell in a body, I've made a difference for the whole body.
Armand DeMille here with Roberta Atti. I'm interviewing Roberta Atti, author of books on poetry, nutrition, psychotherapist, counselor. So just to get this now, so you went along and you started learning how to take care of yourself. You went through nutrition. You started learning those. And I want people to know that there are many people I've met who have the more formal education. Didn't you ever want the formal education in medicine or something like that? Would you have liked to have gotten that?
I would have loved it, but I never would have gotten the knowledge and the understanding that I have if I had done that.
What would you have gotten?
A lot of notions, a lot of knowledge, textbook knowledge. I am very lucky to have a photographic memory when it comes to reading medical literature, so I can learn it quickly, so I would have learned a lot of it. But, and I can still do that, even though I don't do it through medical school. But I find that that way of learning is supportive of my mind in a particular way. It gives me the structure, but it does not give me the dynamic, approach that I have.
If someone would have come to you with a desire to know a little more about their own chemistry, okay, Roberta, somebody comes to you and says, well, my doctor just put me on antibiotics, and they said, here's what I want to know. The antibiotic is called Keflex, and I'm supposed to take it 4 times a day. How is it going to affect my body? Because I need to take it because I have a serious infection.
What are you asking me to do, Armand?
I'm asking you to show how you would approach that with a person.
Well, first of all, I would never go against what a doctor recommends. I would work with it rather than against it.
That's exactly what I mean. So how do you work with somebody who takes, for example, antibiotics?
I know what antibiotics do, and so I know how to counteract the negative side effects.
Could you give me an example of that? What do antibiotics do?
They suppress the immune system.
Is that exactly all they're doing? That's why we take
them? They're killing friendly bacteria that we need in order to digest and assimilate food, for instance.
So you're talking about all the bad things.
Right.
What do they do that's good?
They suppress the immune system. Sometimes the immune system, when we have a symptom that's very acute and painful and dangerous, by toning down the immune response, we are actually helping the body sometimes to cope with whatever it is, the infection in this case. So sometimes it's a good thing to tone down the immune system response, but there's a price we pay for that.
Wait, before we go there, I know I've got you all the way on the negative side. I'm trying to ask you to be the person who understands the antibiotics. So far, you've said to me that antibiotics are a general suppressant of the immune system.
But that's not a,
aren't
I don't
they
say
specific?
That meaning,
don't they hit specific bugs?
I don't mean to say that in a negative way.
Okay, but do antibiotics hit specific bugs? When you
yes.
test, how does it do that? Not by suppressing the total immune system. Sometimes they go very specific.
The antibiotic can be toxic for certain bacteria.
And how does it do that?
It kills it.
How?
Like it's a poison for the bacteria.
And so how does it do it?
It encounters the bacteria, the one that's causing the infection.
So the antibiotic goes in your bloodstream.
Goes in the bloodstream.
Okay, so now we have this chemical in our bloodstream, right?
Right.
Is it a chemical?
Yeah.
It's a chemical.
Well, everything is a chemical in
right,
the bloodstream.
Right, so now we have a chemical going around the bloodstream, right? And it's going around the bloodstream and it runs into, oh, there's that infection. The guy's got this infection in his lung.
Right. So there's an overproduction of a certain kind of bacteria because the immune system of the person is not able to keep that infection under control. So the antibiotic goes in and helps destroying that bacteria.
How does it, doesn't the white blood, aren't the white blood cells supposed to do that?
At that point, when you have an infection that's out of control, white blood cells are not able to do the job anymore.
So this is like calling in an extra army, and this army is coming in. What an antibiotic does is it comes in and it joins your army of white blood cells, and it says to it, look, you can't do this job. Let me get in there and blast this guy. And the antibiotics come in, and they, you know, it could be sulfur drugs. It could be any number of antibiotics. They come in, and they do that. Now, in the process, you're saying they also wipe out other things. We're going to get right back to that. I want to hear this story because I want to watch the march through the human body that you understand. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. It is just about 1 o'clock here at WBAI 99.5 FM. Hey, how would you like to hear some very, very gentle, beautiful music? Let me play something for you by one of my favorites. It reminds me of you, Roberta, because this is Leontine Price. She's probably one of the most beautiful voices in the world today, but certainly not an ordinary kind of person, somebody who's gone out of the normal way and become one of the stars. Here, my friends. Gentlewoman, and then when we come back, we're going to talk with Roberta about the war that goes on, and if it is a war, and how she sees the world. Leontine Price, La Rondine, Chi, Il Bel Sonno. Oops. Chi, Il Bel Sogno di Doretta. Am I pronouncing that right? Probably. Was close to it.
Yeah, that was good.
Leontine Price. Let me, before we go just a step further, let me read to you, my friends. Here's a poem. It's called Eternity. I was walking down my path one day and stumbled upon eternity. I was surprised. It didn't look at all like I thought it would. I expected space and time merging in a stream of creation. Galaxies giving birth to solar systems, black holes opening into parallel universes, restless atoms zooming in and out of reality. I thought I would see the world's soul suspended in bliss. But eternity didn't look like any of that. It was a hairy bumblebee gently caressing the tiny purple flowers in a lavender bush. A tear, plump and salty, rushing to join the ocean out of the corner of a baby's eye. A cricket in love, playing his part in a majestic choral symphony. A seahorse galloping the undercurrents of a tropical sea. A pearl, white and full of tiny rainbows. It was my heart, pulsating gently, rocking my life back and forth. I picked up eternity because it was so pretty, and now I carry it with me wherever I go. That's from Soul Purpose by Roberta Atti. That's one of her poems. Remarkable. More of them available. We're in an adventure. We're talking about Roberta Atti and her perception of the world. And, of course, many of you know this, but I think you like the adventure. I think you like the picture of what it's like to take place in the body. If we say killing the immune system, you can't see it. See a few bugs, though, that you can see. Antibiotics, we're back on the antibiotics. Okay, Roberta? So somebody has an infection. In case anybody tuned in, we're interviewing Roberta Atti. at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. So we've got this infection. You got an infection, and it's making you feel bad. And you know you're feeling bad. You're running a temperature. Everybody knows what it's like to get an infection. You have this infection, then now you take this antibiotic, and the antibiotic is going to go kill these bugs. It joins the white blood cells. It goes over to where the infection site is and says, I'm going to take you on. And if you're lucky, the antibiotics are successful in killing that specific bacteria, right?
Okay. I think I would like to give you a picture, Armand. Imagine that you have a warehouse. And in the warehouse, there's an accumulation of whatever you're storing there. Let's say that you're storing food in there. So for some reason, there's an accumulation of food because the doors don't open, the food cannot get delivered, so you have more and more and more. So now you have rats coming into the warehouse and feasting, or any kind of pest that comes when you have an overabundance of something like that, then maybe the food is rotting because it's not being delivered, it's not being utilized. So now you have this pest, and you have to get rid of the pest. So now you come with a spray, something to kill the pest, spray it all around, and you get rid of the pest. And you know, in a way, you've solved the problem. But have you really? So
okay,
this
but
is
wait,
what
let's
happens.
Let's go with that for a minute. That's okay. A very good image. I like it.
Okay.
Okay, so before we go on to the trashing of it, right, the reasons the doctors have this medication, antibiotics, which, I mean, some people could get rid of things without antibiotics. Some are life-threatening.
No, they are life-threatening.
I mean, but some diseases are life-threatening.
Absolutely.
And it's the only path to take.
Oh, it's a blessing, without a doubt. It's a blessing.
Give me an example of one disease where it's...
Leprosy. Two pills of penicillin can save a person from leprosy. That, to me, is one of the
greatest... Tell me how that works. What do you mean?
You find out you've been infected.
But how come there are so many lepers?
Because they don't have penicillin. You find out you've been infected with leprosy. You start to get the first symptoms. You take two penicillin pills. You're cured. You tell me that's not a miracle.
Couldn't you do that through nutrition?
I am not sure, Armand.
You don't know. You don't have that kind of belief.
No, not in
if
that.
If you got
there
a case that's
extreme.
Life-threatening, where you say, look, you got that in your system. If somebody had a urinary infection, you might feel differently.
Well, but even with that, I would not mess with it because it could go up into the kidneys and cause the person a lot of problems. I would say take the antibiotic, get rid of it, then you start over and you start over in a different way and you start, if you've had a situation where you've had a pest and you've had to get rid of it through spraying, fine, do it, get rid of it. But then you've learned something from that, so let's see if we can prevent that from happening the next time.
Okay, so while you're getting out the weeds to kill the rats, or while you're taking the antibiotics, you know that you're suppressing the immune system, right? You know that is part of the effort. What a lot of people do is they take things like green juice while they're taking antibiotics to kind of build up their immune system, but isn't that the opposite idea? Aren't they, in a way, maybe making the bacteria stronger?
Making the bacteria stronger. It's possible that by strengthening the body, you are making the bacteria stronger because you're the host. So, yes, Armand, you're asking me questions that don't have a yes or no answer. It depends on each individual case which is best to do. Sometimes it's a good idea to take juice while on antibiotics. Sometimes for some people it isn't. For instance, I've worked with people with AIDS or cancer whose immune system is so depleted and so incompetent that they get every possible infection that comes around the corner. And green juices are not always a good idea for these folks because they stimulate the body too much when the body is too depleted. So you're boosting the immune system too much, whereas you have to kind of be slow and gentle with it. So it's for some people, it can be a good idea to do that. For some people, it might not.
You've worked with AIDS people and with cancer people.
Sure.
So talk a little about your AIDS work.
Well, I worked for a while at GMHC, Gay Men's Health Crisis, and I worked in the child life department. I worked as in the nutrition department there. And what we did was we provided folks, families affected by AIDS, with nutritious food and counseling and support in every possible kind of way. We even gave them Santa for Christmas. You know, we invited all the children and we gave them gifts, and the whole thing was just wonderful. So I worked with people with AIDS, and one of the most touching experiences I had, in fact, was during that time when, at Christmas time, we were giving out these gifts, and there were all these children patiently waiting in line, many of them HIV positive and taking AZT and therefore, you know, suffering and suffering with diarrhea and suffering with all kinds of problems. And they were waiting for their turn to get the present from Santa. And I went down there and there was this child sitting on the floor with his head on his knees. And I picked him up, Armand, and he was just skin and bones. And he looked at me and he was so tired. And I sat down on a couch holding him like that. And a few months after that, he died. He fell asleep in my arms. And we were both kind of waiting for Santa there, you know? And I find those experiences along my path of learning about the human body and health, I've encountered the sickest of the sickest, you know, the people who are close to death. And I have found that sometimes the greatest gifts of life come from those folks for me. The greatest lessons, the greatest learning, the greatest heart-opening experiences. I mean, the trust that this dying kid had as he fell asleep in my arms, the trust he had, and the honor to be able to hold him like that is something I will never forget.
Have you seen many people die or known many people who have died?
I've seen quite a number of people die. In India, I would often come across people who were dying of starvation. And sometimes I'd sit by them and I'd chase the flies off of their faces, and I just whisper in their ears, you know.
What would you whisper?
I love you.
Why? I mean, of course, you didn't have to. You didn't always feel like, I got to do something.
No, it wasn't to do anything. There was nothing to do. I couldn't have done anything, but it was just so that they wouldn't be alone. Because these were folks that were dying alone on the street, in the dirt, covered with flies, of starvation. And, you know, their cheeks were sucked in, their eyes were sunken in, they smelled bad, they had rags on them, they were full of ulcers, and they were being eaten alive by flies. So I'd chase the flies off of their bodies, and sometimes I'd put water on their lips, and I'd just whisper, you know, just so they knew they weren't alone. I can't stand the idea of people dying alone, Armand. That's one thing I really think, that, like, we have midwives to help people come through the gate of life. We should also have midwives helping people leave through the gate of death. I think we need both.
When you, as you've traveled through the world and you've been around a lot of illness, have you also been working with people who have cancer and things like that in hospitals?
Yes.
What was the setting? Where would you do that as well?
People who were dying from lung cancer, for instance, there's a stage, one of the final stages of lung cancer is when people can no longer speak or do anything. They can only just rant and breathe, you know, whatever little airspace there is left. And so as they suffocate, their consciousness, you know, changes and goes through stages. There's a time when people are ready to die, and I think we should respect that. You know, we shouldn't interfere with that. So I would do the same thing. Basically, I need to
wipe
my eyes. But of course, I've also worked with people who weren't at that stage. And
you can say there's a point at which a person realizes that they're dying.
No, there's a point in which the body gets ready to die, and that at that point the body stops taking in food.
Right, I've seen
that's
that.
When people stop eating, and everyone around them usually at that point tries to force them to eat. And that's the worst thing that we can do for these folks, because when the body says I've had enough, what we need to do is the opposite. We need to help the person die and respect the fact that the body no longer wants to nourish itself. So I've spent a lot of time with people who were wasting, meaning that had reached that point and now were in the process of dying. And sometimes it would be peaceful, and sometimes it would be not so peaceful. And I think that just a presence at those moments is all that's needed to make the person's transition easier.
A little earlier today, I interviewed a man who came to see me from far away, and he was sick. I mean, you could tell he had a lot of illnesses, and he had a lot of answers, too. He had answers for everything. I know I'm this. I know I should do this. I know I should do this. You meet that person, and I know I introduced you to him. You met him.
Yes.
What's your response when you meet someone like that, when you see somebody and you meet them and they are sick? Do you want to reach out your hand and help them? I had a good...
Well, I did give him a hug. I held him in my arms for quite a while. I respond as if it were a child who's sick and needs comforting. And I don't mean to diminish, you know, I don't mean to diminish the person or become or feel superior in any way. I just see a need that's crying out for something. And I just don't know exactly what that is. I'm not saying I can fill that need, but I can be with that person with that need.
We're with Roberta Atti. We're talking it's basically an interview about Roberta Atti, and I think you're hearing the remarkable person that I know and what she's about. You're with a person, Roberta. They come to you with their many illnesses. They come to you trying to repeat they're going to repeat the patterns over and over again. You help it, but not, obviously, not by just advising nutrition, right? That's not your idea. You think of what you call soul repair. Now, I'm going to say to those of you who are skeptical, I think when Roberta talks about soul repair, she's talking about something, but I've always seen it as heart repair. You know, and whether it includes some spiritual element or not a spiritual element, I don't know for sure, but I know that you're working at getting a person to feel loved while they're trying to take care of themselves, and even if they don't take care of themselves, you let them feel loved anyway, right?
Yes. I find that is the most effective thing I can do. I'm not saying this is true for every other counselor.
How do you make believe you love everybody?
I don't make believe. That's truly what I feel.
That's why you can't do short sessions, you know.
Yeah, I can't do short sessions because I just don't get enough of that person if the session is too short. I need to in that session. It's not just their need. I'm exchanging a human moment, and I'm not going to shortchange myself in the name of money.
Roberta Atti, I think another thing that happens with you is that you need the time to establish the bond so that you could actually access the part of you that loves them.
Well, of course.
You know, that's it. So you want to access that part. Then through there, you'll help people. And if you find somebody, let's say you find somebody who comes to you and says, well, I like pizza, I like grilled cheese, I like pastrami sandwiches, I like McDonald's, and then I take a B-complex and a one-a-day vitamin, every day, and at night I take some tryptophan. So I'm at least nutritionally conscious.
You know, Armand, my technique that I've developed is whatever the problem is that a person presents me with, what I do is I look for the beauty in that person, and there's always beauty, even when they don't see it. And I feast on that myself first. I take it in as much as I can. I look for it, I find it. Sometimes it's more readily available than other times, but I find it. That's the only thing I focus on. People will go in detail into why they're coming to see me and what they need from me, and they explain all these things, but while they're talking, I focus on the beauty. Whatever they're saying, whatever. Once I find that and I fall in love with that, then my advice or whatever response I'm going to have to that person comes from that place. And so I'm taking into account that person's need as opposed to applying a generalized, you know, approach to, okay, the person that you just described a while ago, I would look at the beauty of how they're really doing their best to take care of themselves and how endearing that is. And they just lack certain pieces of information. So I would start
so
by
saying... there's a person who's on the run, and they're moving from one place to the other.
And
they stop in
they
at McDonald's, and they grab a McDonald's hamburger, and then they go and they grab a Coke because they're on the run. And there's a beauty to you in how they are in motion.
Sure, sure. And,
right?
And how they're doing this, you know, and then at night they take the tryptophan. And how they take the B complex. There's a beauty in that that I focus on. And then I reflect it back to them. I say, wow, this is great that you're doing this. Let's see what we can do to make it even better, because you're already doing a great job. And I find that that works better than to say, well, you shouldn't eat the McDonald's, and you shouldn't do this, and you shouldn't do that, because look at what you're doing to yourself. It's really bad, and it's bad for the planet. Making people feel guilty or ashamed never seems to work.
It seems to work in some short run. You know, they come to you in nutritional advice, but you see all the people who go for nutritional advice, and that's one thing. Take B complex, take this. If the person has got an illness, then you might be very direct. Here's what I found works. You could take this supplement and that supplement and eat this food and avoid that food, right?
That's information, and I do give that, and it does help people. It seems to work rather well. So that's part of it. But it does not come from a standardized approach on how to cure this, how to fix that. It comes from taking the person in, really feeling what they're about, and working with that individual.
So if you met a person who was like an 8 in the Enneagram, who had AIDS, for example, and you knew that they're not going to take more than 3 medication, that anything that you recommend, you know they're not going to do it. You know they're not going to take a lot of supplements. Instead of giving them the best recommendation, which may include 12 supplements, what would you do?
Well, the 12 supplements is not going to work for them, because if it doesn't work for them, it doesn't work for them.
And they're not going to take them.
And they're not going to take them. And even if they did, it would not work for them, because that's not how their mind is. So how is this person's mind, and where is the beauty? The beauty is in the independence. So let's let them be independent. Let's let them feel that they're in charge of whatever it is that they're doing. And let's put things out in such a way that that aspect is not going to be threatened or diminished, because that's their survival. That's how.
Well,
they
how
survive.
Would you put it out? How do you put it out to somebody who wants to be in charge? Do you say to them, "So, what do you think would be a good idea for you if you
right,
have?"
Right. I would say, "What are you willing to do? How much are you willing to take?" And they'll say, "I won't take more than 3 supplements." Okay, let's figure out which 3 are the most could be the most beneficial to you. And then we work from there. And I let them feel that they're the ones making the decision as opposed to me. Now, there are other people, Armand, like, for instance, 2s in the Enneagram, who need me to make decisions for them. In fact, they come to me, and then after I explain to them very well what they need to do, the same night I hear the phone call, here it comes. Are you sure I need to do it this way? Exactly. But do I need to take it now or a half hour from now? Do I take it with half a glass of water or a glass of water? They need specific instructions, then I give them that.
You know a lot about nutrition, don't you?
Yes, I do.
You know a lot about medicine, don't you?
I do. In fact, I believe I know more than most people I've met.
I think so too, Roberta.
And that doesn't come from a place of...
ego.
Ego, no. It comes from observation.
So, my friends, that's... this is from The Lioness. Roberta, where did the poem The Lioness come from?
It came from a day when I was very angry and I didn't know what to do with that anger. I didn't want to hurt anyone and I didn't want to hurt myself, so I put it down on paper.
Many years I spent empty and dry and hungry, believing that love could be taken away for good, condemned to a life of dull moonlight and mute stars and heavens contained. Languishing within the prison of a finite mind that looked upon itself with disdain and wept, as if lost in a dark, endless sea of calm, death-like waters. But the storm came with a gift of fury to set me free from the eventless eternity of my imagination, made still by my fears of what powers might lie beneath my heart. I am a raging lioness, blinded by the heat of my own blood. Bursting through memories hidden inside my savage brain, I feast on my own hesitations. I tear into my bones and release eons of doubts. I sink my teeth into a prudent flesh in order to realign my molecules and claim a glory. I only know of from distant dreams. It's just the beginning of a beautiful poem, which I just realize. Where more would you like to read the rest? Right there.
I'll try, but you know sometimes I stutter. And when I find myself consumed by the very beast I thought I had tamed and killed, I am finally free to disperse my consciousness onto the vast tapestry to which I belong, a single, eternal, undying, luminous love thread, glistening with delight, dripping joy, belonging with splendor to the weaver, whose cloth remains untouched by the moths who live in the darkest caves. Blood renewed, sight restored, flesh reborn, soul alighted, my endless journey needs no goal. I'll sleep a while, and when my strength is back, I shall hunt again, because I love.
Roberta Auntie. A copy of Roberta's book is available. You could contact her at Roberta for Health. Roberta for Health. Roberta, thank you very much for this.
Thank you, Armand.
If you want a copy of today's program, you could call 1-800-575-0580.